على آله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. At the age of 25, we see that the Messenger of Allah married his wife, Bibi Khadija, and after the marriage, he moved out of his neighborhood, which was the neighborhood of Bani Hashim, to the house of Khadija, which she had given to him with the rest of her property. And so now, from this point onwards, you see that the Prophet lived in her house and in her neighborhood, not in the neighborhood of Bani Hashim. He did not live there. This is very important when it comes to the future and the events that's going to happen after his announcement of prophethood. Now, this was a very ideal move and a very tactical move, because the issue is that as he now became and lived after that for 15 years, he was known as someone who lived in the neighborhood of Khadija's family, not in the neighborhood of his own family. Now, this went a long way that after the announcement of prophethood, when sides were drawn and enemies became clear and opposition became strong, they, if he had stayed in the neighborhood of Bani Hashim, it would have been easy for the enemies to target the neighborhood of Bani Hashim and to put a siege on them and to put them to adversities. But because he lived in the neighborhood of Bani Zuhra, which is Khadija's family, and the enemies, they said, well, we don't have anything against them, and they have nothing to do with his religion, so there was nowhere or no place where the enemies could actually target to do anything aggressively in order to stop him or those who are supporting him. And this is, you see, the far-sighted vision that the Prophet had of moving to the house and neighborhood of his wife and staying there from that time onwards. And the other thing that happened after that is because now he was in charge of the property that was previously owned by his wife, and now he was doing business. The businessmen of Makkah and other places found it relatively easier to deal with him, because now they were not afraid of investing in him because they knew he had the backing if there was any loss. So now they started dealing with him as an equal. So on one hand, you see that the reputation of the Prophet was there amongst the businessmen and the rich people of Makkah, and that he established himself as someone that they could rely on. Now obviously he was already trustworthy, and people regarded him as trustworthy. But this was also an apparent trust in knowing that he's wealthy now and he's well-to-do. This was really important in the message that he was going to give, that is there to support the poor. Usually it happens if a poor person fights for the right of the poor, then that means that's in his self-interest, because he's poor and he wants to get rich, right? He wants some of the milk and honey that the rich people have, right? So he wants something out of it. But then when a rich person fights for the rights of the poor, then people will look at it and say, well, he has nothing to gain and he has everything to lose. So what he's saying is out of sincerity. And this is the reason why Allah made him wealthy, so that when he fights for the rights of the poor and the oppressed, then people will look at him and say, well, then what this voice that he's raising for the oppressed and for the poor people is out of sincerity and out of true wanting to have a change in society, not someone who wants his own interest and is taking his own interest into account. So based on that, you see, the next 15 years of the prophet were lived. And now towards the end of that, from the age of 25 to 40 is what I'm going to try to cover today. Now, there's not a lot of history in that time, but it began off when as soon as he got married, he got involved in business, he got involved in trade and more trade and expanded the business until the age of 35. After 35, or some people say 33, the prophet suddenly gave up the business to other people, delegated responsibilities, put the managers in charge of trade and all that, and slowly began to isolate himself and to seclude himself. This is the time that the historians and the ulama say that he was actually seeing visions, and he was now trying to concentrate and contemplate and worship and spend his time in worship. Especially the last 5 years, you see, he was hardly seen in Mecca. He was hardly seen in Mecca, and so he was mostly contemplating, he was mostly doing his ibadat and spending his time in isolation. Well, that a lot of history has been written in these 15 years. Two incidents are there that I will mention to you, some historical incidents that happened that had a huge effect on Islam and the prophethood of our messenger. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, I'm just going to mention these two incidents. One I'll mention before the other, and they're not like historically, you know, historically the second one will come first, and the first one will come second, but because of the fact that we are going to discuss regarding Amir al-Mu'mineen today, so I'll mention the first one second. The first incident, you know, that I will mention that had a huge impact on the Prophet and what's going to happen in the future, again, establishing the Prophet as a decision maker and as a leader. There was an incident that happened in Mecca that led the Meccan society to almost having a civil war. And they were so close to drawing their swords and killing each other. It was so bad, and the situation was so tense that people were really on the verge of destruction. People were looking at the situation and there was no hope. It was like, for example, this is the end. Everyone's going to kill each other. Now, what was that incident? Well, there are three things that happened in 1 year. And this was when the Prophet was 35 years old. Or some say 33. In that time, there are three things that happened there. The first thing that happened there is that there was a huge torrential rain that came. Now, if you know Mecca, those who have been to Mecca know that the Kaaba sits inside of a valley surrounded by mountains. Those who have been to Umrah and Hajj would know that. The Kaaba is right underneath, and on all the sides are mountains. If you ever paid attention to those mountains, you'll see that there's a wall on the mountain. Right? Ever see a wall on the mountain, you know? And, you know, obviously when I went there the first time, I was looking at the wall on the mountain. I said, why did they build a wall on a mountain for? Right? And, you know, so on and so forth. Why would they do that? You see, there's a wall right there on the mountain, all the way across the mountains, right? Well, here's the thing. This wall is not new. The wall was built even in those days. The reason the wall is built is because whenever rains would come, and now it doesn't rain a lot in Mecca, but when it does rain, the water on the mountains comes right down into the valley and easily floods the valley, which obviously will flood the Kaaba. You might have seen pictures of the Kaaba flooded, right? It doesn't require a lot of rain to do that, because whatever rain is going to hit the mountain is going to slide right off into the basin. And this is usually what happens. So they made these walls in order that the rain that falls and is coming down is diverted away from the Kaaba. That's why these walls were built in those days. Now, what year? That year there was a large amount of rain in which the water went above the wall and came down. Now, when it came down, it flooded the Kaaba in a very bad way. That was one incident that happened. Now, if you know the history of the Kaaba was first, the foundation of the Kaaba was laid down by Jibreel and Adam. They laid down the foundation. They said, these are the markings on the ground of the foundation, right? Then after that, the person who built the Kaaba was Ibrahim. Ibrahim built the Kaaba at the order of Allah. When he came back after leaving his son and his wife, he came back with the directive that now you build the Kaaba. So he and Ismail built the Kaaba. Now, when the Kaaba was being built, he was given the material and all that to build it. So he was doing the actual work. He was the carpenter doing the work. So as he was doing, you know, the work, you see most of the signs that Allah speaks about regarding Hajj and in Hajj are related to this construction of the Kaaba. When Ibrahim was building the Kaaba with Ismail, so obviously they were like laying down the bricks on the wall of the Kaaba. They're laying down the bricks on the wall of the Kaaba. So as they're laying down the bricks, now for example, they'll come to one extent, right, until their height. Now, beyond their height, how are they going to reach there? There's no ladders there. You can't go to a hardware store and get a ladder in those days, right? There's no ladder. How would they do that? You know, if, for example, is Ibrahim going to climb, you know, on top of Ismail, or is Ismail going to climb on top of Ibrahim? But still, that won't reach so far, only a few feet. If you look at the Kaaba, it's very tall, right? So now what happened is that for that, in order that Ibrahim lays down the bricks on top or at a greater height than himself, Allah sent down a stone. And now with that stone, Ibrahim would step on the stone, and as he's laying down the bricks, the stone would rise. It would rise, it will go up, and he would lay down the more bricks. And after that construction was done, and he made the whole wall up to the height where it's supposed to be, the stone sat down there and became a sign for all of us. This is known as Maqam-e Ibrahim. Maqam Ibrahim is the stone on which Ibrahim used to sit. It was his ladder that would go up and down in order that Ibrahim takes the bricks on at that height and puts those bricks on the wall as he's making the Kaaba. So that's why when Allah says Maqam Ibrahim is from the ayat of Allah, from the signs of Allah, it is a sign that Allah has sent it from heaven in order that this will be used to build the Kaaba, and it's still there. And the footprints of Ibrahim are on that stone. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So the next time you go there, you would know actually what that Maqam Ibrahim is. And so that you can actually know the history behind it. So now as it was built, when the Kaaba was built and the walls were raised, remember, Ibrahim and Ismail raised the walls of the Kaaba. The Kaaba did not have a roof. It did not have a ceiling. It was only walls. So when the rains come, you know, it comes all the way inside and everywhere, right? Because when you walk into the Kaaba, there is no roof on the top. So this is how it was. Now, that was the first incident that happened that year, was it rained. And it hurt the walls of the Kaaba. Now, between the time of Ibrahim's construction and the time of the Prophet, there was one time in history, 500 years before the Prophet, when the Kaaba was reconstructed. It was reconstructed, it was damaged, and it was reconstructed. And after this construction, now in the time of the Prophet, it's been 500 years since the Kaaba was reconstructed. So now obviously the walls are getting old. It's not, for example, built to last for a lot of time. And so there was a drape around the Kaaba. You know, the drape that started from where? From the time when the king of Yemen came and he put the drape on the Kaaba 150 years before, that drape is still there, and so it's hiding the actual Kaaba. Now what happened? The second incident happened. The second incident happened at the hands of a devoted woman who went inside and wanted to light up some incense. You know, like, you know, incense that we have, right? Incense sticks. She wanted to light up some incense sticks to make the Kaaba smell good. So in her haste or whatever she did, the fire, spread and it caught the drape of the Kaaba. And when it caught the drape of the Kaaba, the whole drape burned down. So the whole outside of the Kaaba burned down. And when the people saw that the drape burned down, they never saw the Kaaba without the drape. So when they actually saw the Kaaba burned down, the drapes of the Kaaba burned down, they were able to see the naked wall. And they looked at the wall and they saw that this wall is about to fall. It's a flimsy wall, 500 years old, water damage, all these years, weather and all these things are taking its toll on the walls of the Kaaba and it is like ready to fall down. So that was another thing that everyone is looking at and say, this is dangerous, right? We need to do something about this. So this was the second thing that happened. And the third incident that happened that really sparked an interest in the whole of Makkah was the fact that there was a theft at the Kaaba. Yes, there was a theft at the Kaaba. A thief came and stole something valuable. Now, thieves used to come before also and they steal, because imagine this, Kaaba is only walls. You just need to jump the wall and you're in, right? So, I mean, it's not like Fort Knox or something. You really have to go hard in there. It's very easy. You just jump the wall and you're there. Now, a lot of people give gifts to the Kaaba, they give expensive gifts, this and that. Now, if you remember, some king had given to the Kaaba, donated 2 golden deers. Now, those golden deers were made of gold, and so they were regarded as expensive, as one of the, the mainstay donation of the Kaaba. So that time, the thief or the thieves, whoever it was, stole the 2 deers, the golden deers. And when the 2 golden deers were missing, now there was an uproar in Makkah as to, hey, we need to do something about this. We see the Kaaba is about to fall down. We see thieves getting inside the Kaaba. I mean, what kind of place is this? Who's in charge here? Who's running this place? Right? So everyone's upset. Everyone wants to do something. So they all recognize the fact that, hey, we need to build the Kaaba. We need to rebuild the Kaaba. But the issue is not about building the Kaaba. The main issue that everyone is concerned about is that in order to build it, first you have to break it down. So now the question is, who's going to break it down? Because no one wants to do that. No one wants to be the one, who would go down in history as the one who broke down the Kaaba. I mean, they are non-Muslims here. They're idol worshippers, but they still respect the Kaaba. It's honored. And to them, looking at the Kaaba is like, we don't want to break it down. No one wants to break it down. Now, so they're all waiting, right, for something to happen or some sign or something to say that, it's okay. No one wants to put the bell on the cat. No one wants to do the dirty work. Who's going to do that? Now, all the people in Makkah, they're all deciding until one day, this person who, a traveler, comes from Jeddah. Jeddah is a port, right? Jeddah was the port in those days, right? And so a traveler comes from there next to the Kaaba, coming to visit the Kaaba, and they were like hanging out with some of the people in the Kaaba, in Makkah and all that thing. And he jokes around, and he was joking around about, a joke that happened at the port. What was the joke at the port? He says, you know what? This person, he said that this ship, a Roman ship, right? A Roman ship, he says the captain of the Roman ship, he ran the ship into ground. And they were having a big laugh about it, right? And he thinks he's a captain. He doesn't even know how to captain a ship. He ran it right into the ground. Now the ship is stuck and all these things. And they were like laughing about it. And one of the person there is like, what? What are you talking about? He says, yeah, a ship ran the ground, this and that. So what does it have? It's laden with wood. They were transporting wood, carrying wood. That person heard this and said, wait a minute. He went to the chiefs of Makkah and says, listen, there's a ship at the port. The captain ran the ship into the ground and everyone laughed. And then after that, he said, but wait, there's wood on that ship. This is wood on that ship? Yes. Maybe he's willing to sell it. Let's go and buy it. Because here's the thing. You want to build a Kaaba, you need wood. There is no wood in Makkah or in that region because it's a desert. There's no wood. So they say, let's go and see if it's true. So a person by the name of Walid ibn Mughayra. Now Walid ibn Mughayra is one of the bad guys, right? You might know his son. His son's name is Khalid ibn Walid, right? That's his son, right? So Walid ibn Mughayra, one of the people who used to insult the Prophet and do all these things in the future, but that's the future right now. Right now, he's also a citizen of Makkah. In those meetings, you know, about the Kaaba and all these things, the talks are going on. So he heads the effort, meaning that he was sent with some people to go and inquire about the ship. So they go to the port of Jeddah and they actually look at the ship and they meet the captain, whose name is, it says Makun, but Malcolm or something like that. Right, so Malcolm, the captain, he is like now looking. They speak with him and says, "Hey, listen, you know, you ran the ship to the ground, you know." He's like, "All right, you know, enough of that, right? You know, what do you all want?" He said, "Listen, we are willing to buy your, you know, your product you have there, the wood that you have here." So the captain's like, "Of course, you know, this is great because there's no way for me to now shift it to another ship. That's going to help me out. If you take it, if you buy it, that's great." So they settle for a price and they get the wood. The wood that would have been so expensive because they would have to go to Syria to buy the wood. And they had to transport it from there. They're getting it in their backyard for cheap, for dirt price. So they view it as some sort of a sign. You know, maybe your God wants us to build it. God wants us to do this. That's why he's arranging it right here. So they thank Malcolm and this and that. Now they find out that this Malcolm, who's the captain of the ship carrying this wood, they talk to him and they get to know that he's also an engineer. He's an architect and an engineer who does this as a job, as a profession. He was taking this wood in order to build something. So when they found out that he's an engineer and an architect at the same time, they're like, "Whoa. You know, why don't we hire you also to do and to come with us and all that?" So when they also hire him, so with his engineering skill and architecture skill, they also find the wood that goes there. So now they come back to Makkah with what they found, which is the wood and a person who can build it, who has the know-how to build it. They come back with it. When they come back with it, obviously they show that everyone's happy. They see it as a sign to build a Kaaba. But again, the question is, who's going to break it down first? Who's going to be the one who's going to hit the first axe on the Kaaba? So Walid ibn Mughayra says, "All right, you know what? I'll do it. Let me be the bad guy. I'll do it. This is needed and we're going to do it." So he goes there and he breaks off the first brick. Now this is made with bricks, right? With bricks type thing, not the stones that we see right now. The old one was built with bricks. So he breaks down the first brick. As soon as he breaks that brick down, all of a sudden, there's an eclipse in the sky. There's an eclipse in the sky, and everyone looks at the eclipse happening, and then they see snakes coming out. Then, you know, it looks like, you know, Day of Judgment is here, and everyone runs home screaming, right? Now the whole city is hysterical. It's like Godzilla came, you know? And they're all running from here and there and all like scared, what's going on? What the heck is happening? Now, until then, Bani Hashim are not involved. Abu Talib is not involved. The Prophet is not involved. No one is involved in any of these things that's going on. So as this is happening, these people, they come to Abu Talib knowing that he is a man of God. He's a person of prayer and he's our chief. So they come to him and say, "Hey, listen, look what's happening, you know. This and that. I think there might be, you know, punishment for us and all these things." So now what happened is that Abu Talib comes out. He goes to the Kaaba. And Abu Talib prays to Allah. He prays to Allah and says, "Allah, our intention of doing this is not to disrespect the Kaaba, but to rectify it, to make it better, to make it stronger." And as he makes this prayer, right away the eclipse goes away, the snakes disappear, everything finds and becomes normal again. So now the people are like, "All right, you know, here's what we'll do, right? Since Walid ibn Mughayra did it, right, we'll wait for the night. If we find him alive tomorrow, it means that we're good to go. Right? So they come to this decision. I mean, obviously, they're not like believers or anything. You know, they work on their fears and they work on their superstitions. Right? So they think that since he broke it, and if God is against it, so he's going to punish him at night and kill him. Right? With some strange disease. So if you don't see him dying of a strange disease, then we're good to go. So everyone is waiting to see Walid ibn Mughira the next day. Right? And as it happened, the next day, right, he was okay. He was alive. So as soon as they found that he was alive and he's okay and he's healthy, so they said, okay, it's time to go and we can do this. So they broke down the walls of the Kaaba. They broke down the walls of the Kaaba and then they asked for donations. They asked for donations, you know, ask everyone to give donations to build. Now they have the wood already. They have the person who's going to build it. They have certain things, but they need much more than that. So a lot of people, obviously, the Kaaba is dear to them. Kaaba is their bread and butter. Kaaba is what made Makkah. Kaaba is the source and everything that has to do with Makkah. And they all know it. They owe everything to the Kaaba. So everyone wants to donate now. As they are donating this, a huge amount of wealth is amassed. Everyone is giving their jewelry or gold or whatever they have. A huge amount of jewelry is amassed. And now they want to build the Kaaba with it. And hence now they see that as jewelry is there, they see that, you know, again, according to one riwayat that says that there was the snakes that were still there would not let them even come close. They said, okay, if you go close, you know, we'll be hurt. And so, you know, they were staying back and they saw that as an omen not to do this. Why it's happening right now, they came to Abu Talib again. Abu Talib now gave them a principle. He says, listen, this is the house of God. You want to build the house of God? Then only that money will be used that is not earned through wrong means. Anyone who has earned money through stealing, through lying, through deceiving, through anything like that, you cannot use money here. Otherwise, God doesn't want you to build his house through that money. So anyone who has that money, take it out. So this is Makkah now, right? So when all the people who heard that if you have money from stealing and lying and cheating and all these things come out, so they took the money out and nothing was left. La ilaha illallah. Salawat ala Muhammad. Only a little bit was left, right? And they looked at it and now they're like, you know, now with this amount of money, we can't build the whole thing. We can't do all of this that we wanted to build because the design of the Kaaba, according to Ibrahim's size, you know, is where, for example, it is more of a rectangular shape. That even the Hatim, which is the Hajr Ismail, is also included in that. Now, wow, when we look at the Kaaba, it is smaller than that. You know, it's smaller than that. And the reason it's smaller is not because they didn't want to build the right size. They just didn't have the money then to build the whole size. That's why we have a smaller Kaaba now. Then. And after that, no one ever had the guts to build it again. So now as they built to the size, Abu Talib says, just build with what you have and build with money that is halal, that is right. So as they build the Kaaba, they build it smaller than that. That's why it is said that, for example, when you do the tawaf of the Kaaba, you go around the Hatim, around the wall of Ismail, Hijr Ismail. The reason you go around it is because that's also the Kaaba. And stay 4 feet away from it because it's 4 feet bigger than the wall of Hatim right now. So don't even, when you're doing the tawaf, and many people don't know this, when you do the tawaf, you can't be next to the wall. You can't be next to the wall, holding the wall while you're doing the rounds. You have to be 4 feet away from there. So now what happened is you have to be 4 feet away from there. People don't know that and they do it inside. If you do it inside, then your tawaf is wrong. So even then, when you are making the rounds, make sure you do that. Because what happened is that when they built the Kaaba, they did not have enough resources to build it to its original size, to the size that Ibrahim had designed it, to the size that Ibrahim had built it, to the size that Jibreel and Adam had laid down the foundation for it. After that, the Prophet did not change it. After that, the Imams did not change it. The Prophet in one hadith, many hadiths has said that I'm leaving this here. I'm leaving this here. And the Imams have also said, we're leaving it as it is so that our son, Mahdi, when he comes back, he'll rebuild it to this original size. That's why the Kaaba is going to stay the same until the Imam will come back and he's going to rebuild it to its original size that Ibrahim and Adam had built it on. So now when we look at that, we see that this is how that they build the Kaaba. It was to the soul size. So now as it was built and everyone was taking part in it and all the tribes were taking part in it, now came to that situation which caused the most problem. And that is, listen, right? Who's going to put the Hajar-e-Aswad in the Kaaba? And you all know the story, right? The story of Hajar-e-Aswad, who's going to put that in the Kaaba, right? Because the issue is that any tribe that's going to put it can always say, hey, we are the ones who did it. And any tribe that wouldn't do it will always be looked down as that you never put it there. So everyone wants to be a part of it. No one wants the other one to do it. So now everyone's, the situation is tense. Tense to the extent that now they said, you know what? Anyone who gets close to it is going to, fight with the other tribe. There's almost a civil war there now. As the civil war is almost on the verge of happening, of people killing each other, so someone gives the idea and says, all right, here's the thing. Right? And it was nighttime. They're all having this argument, debate, heated debate going on, almost to the verge of taking out their swords. And they said, all right, whoever comes through the door of Shayba in the morning, first person to come through that door in the morning, he is going to decide what to do. Everyone's like looking at each other, all right, And so now they decided the first person who will come through the door of Shayba in the morning is going to be the one to do it. But now the issue is this: if these guys go back, then obviously they'll send someone there, right? So now everyone decides, all right, no one leaves this place. We're going to stay here the whole night. We're going to have a night out right here and keep an eye on each other, right? No one's going to leave this place. We're all looking at each other and we're not going to move from here until the morning comes and we see who's there first. So they stay at night. They won't let anyone go. The whole night they stay there. And as they stay there, now the next morning, the first one to come through the door of Shayba, which is right now Babu Salam, which was the door that the Prophet used to come through and the Imams used to walk through, and it is also mustahab for us to go through that door when we are entering the Kaaba. He comes there through that door and they see him. And as soon as they see him, everyone says, Amin is here. He says, Amin is here. So right away, they are like happy to see that Amin is here. And, he will make a right decision. As soon as he comes there, they're happy that he is here. Everyone is happy. So now the Prophet, when he comes over, they ask them, what's the problem? They give him the problem. And so he said, okay, here's an easy solution. He took out his drape that he had, his abba that he had, put it on the ground. He says, listen, you all hold it. One person from each tribe hold this. From each end, everyone holds it. He says, now I ask you permission on your behalf to put this stone on top of this abba, this cloak. They said, all right, you have our permission. He says, I'm not doing it on behalf of Bani Hashim. I'm doing it on behalf of you who have given me permission. They all said yes. So he puts it there. Then he says, raise it up and let's take it to the Kaaba. They take it to the Kaaba. As soon as they reach there to the Kaaba, then he says again, I ask all of your permission that on your behalf, I'm going to put this in the Kaaba. And they said, all right, you do that on our behalf. So now Rasulullah, acting on behalf of the whole tribes there, he puts the Hajar-e-Aswad into the Kaaba and solves the problem of Makkah going into a civil war and unrest and killing themselves. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala ali Muhammad. So this is the first incident that happened in this age of 35. He was 35 years old at this age, and I told you, this is again to establish the prophet as a decision maker, as a leader, as a person that the rest of the tribes can trust, and that he is able to solve problems for them. Allah is getting them ready again. Now, one last incident I said I'll mention it in brief. And that incident was very simple, my friends, that at that age, Rasulullah was 30 years old, when one day, Fatima bint Asad walks to the Kaaba and hugs the wall of the Kaaba and prays over there. And the people seeing it, the chiefs of Makkah, you know, they saw that. They said that they saw her praying there, and all of a sudden, the wall of the Kaaba cracks and she goes inside. She goes inside and the wall and the crack closes up again. It closes up again. So now as it closes up, now they say, what happened? So they all run there. He said, we all ran there to see, you know, where the crack is and how she went inside. We couldn't do that. So they went to the door and tried to open it. And it was like blocked, solid. They could not open it. They thought it was locked. They tried to push it. They tried to do whatever it can. Nothing happened. After a while, they just gave up. News came, you know, that, you know, she's inside there. And you know what? There's no one in there. And no one can get in. No one can get out. And she stayed there. This happened on the 13th of Rajab. She went inside. And she was there till the 16th of Rajab. 3 days. 3 days she stayed there. Inside. And no one was able to get in. No one was able to get out. My friends, understand this, right? You know, now I'm not going to explain the whole story because you hear this all the time. Right, you hear this all the time at the birth of Imam Ali. You hear the story about his birth and how it takes place, right? But just few things related to prophethood at that time. When she went inside, the prophet, again, Imam, he was not living in the neighborhood of Bani Hashim. He lived in the neighborhood of Bani Zuhra, right, with his wife. So he did not come for 3 days. On the 16th morning is when he came. And he came, as he says, that in the morning, he had a vision. In the vision, it was told to him that Muhammad, wake up and go to the Kaaba, because the one who will be your aid and helper, the one who will be with you until the end, is coming and is being born. And when Rasulullah heard that, he left for the Kaaba. Now in one hadith it says, one riwayat, there are two riwayat. One says that he actually went to the Kaaba, no one was able to open the door. But when the Prophet reached there, the door opened itself. When it opened itself, Rasulullah says, I went inside. I went inside the Kaaba. And as I went inside the Kaaba, I saw some ladies there. I saw some ladies with my aunt, Fatima bint Asad. I saw them over there. I looked at them. And then at that point, there's a drape that came. A drape that came from the sky and made a separation. And the ladies went behind that drape. And I was alone with my aunt. My aunt showed me the baby in her hand. I took the baby in my hand. I looked at the baby. The baby right away pulled his hand towards his ear and started to say the Shahadatain and the Azan. Duraiyah says, now, he looked at the baby. Rasulullah looked at the baby, kissed the baby, and then he asked the baby, and he told the baby, he says, you are he that Allah, meaning Allah who's the most high, has named Ali. And he was named, and then after that, you see, Imam Ali, at that age of infancy, said, Ya Rasulullah, tell me, what should I read for you? Should I read the Zabur? Should I read the Torah? Should I read the Quran? Rasulullah told him, read the Quran. Imam Ali started reading Surah Mu'minun. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Qad aflaha al-Mu'minun. He started reading that. And Rasulullah was listening to it. And in this fashion, you see, this event happened, the birth of Imam Ali. This is crucial because Allah says that he will be your successor and through him will my promise be fulfilled in this world. And from that time, Rasulullah knew of Imam Ali. And from that time, Imam Ali, and you will hear as we go forward in the history of the Prophet, how he, in every situation, and in every event, was there with the Prophet and was there in such a way that he would just let himself go and just completely, in a self-sacrificing way, give everything he had for the Prophet. This is how he was, my friends. Now obviously, going through the history, you will appreciate it more. Going through this history. You know, Isbagh, there was a time when Imam Ali was struck on the head and Imam Ali was lying down. Many people of Kufa came around there to his house, surrounded his house to seek the revenge of Ibn Muljim, the killer. You know, seek revenge of Ibn Muljim, the killer, right? Now, as Imam Ali was there, Imam Hassan came outside, saw the people, and the request is that we need to know what Amir al-Mu'mineen says regarding the killer. So Imam Hassan went inside, got the news from Imam Ali and says, listen, my father has said that he will wait until to see what happens to himself. If he lives, he will deal with it. So you may go now. So he told everyone to leave. Imam Ali is still alive. If something happens, then he will deal with it. So they said, all right. Everyone left except for one person. One person stayed back. His name was Isbagh. Now Isbagh stayed back. Imam Hassan went inside and he came out and saw Isbagh is standing there. He said, Isbagh, you know, we told you that, you know, you can go now. Isbagh says, you know, I don't want to leave. He said, why not? He said, because I don't know if I will ever hear Amir al-Mu'mineen again. Is there any way I can see him so I can listen to him? I can hear something from him. So Imam Hassan went inside and he came out and said, all right, come in. He asked Isbagh to come in. My friends, really, you know, Isbagh is a fortunate person. Right? Most people left because they were told to leave. Sometimes, you know, you just have to be persistent. When you love Ahlul Bayt, be persistent. They will open the door for you. They will open the door for you. Be persistent. He was persistent. I'm not going to leave just like that. I want to hear him. I want to listen to him. I want to hear hadith from him. And he came inside. Imam Ali looked at Isbagh and said, Isbagh, so you didn't leave. Huh? He says, Mawla, I cannot leave you. I need to hear something from you. So Imam Ali said, okay, you want to hear something from me, Isbagh? All right. Let me tell you something, right? So that you can find comfort in that. What is it? He says, you know, he asked him to extend his hand. He extended his hand like this and he held a finger of Isbagh. And Isbagh says, he held my finger, Imam Ali, held my finger and said to him that, Isbagh, you know, when I was in the same situation as you, and Rasulullah was on the deathbed and he was dying, Rasulullah also held my finger like this. He held my finger like this. And then he told me something, which I'm going to tell you now. What is that? He said that on the day of judgment, when everyone is going to be raised, he said that I will be sitting on a big pulpit. I will be brought and I will be sitting on a big pulpit. And Ali, you will be brought. And you will be sitting one step below me. You will sit there. One step below me, you'll be sitting. And below you will be a group of angels that will sit there. And then all the people from the first till the end, every one of them, no matter from where they are, what they are, they will be brought into this field in front of us. Everyone will be brought in the field in front of us. And then one angel will come in front of all of them and will say that if you know me, then you know me. If you don't know me, then know me now. My name is Rizwan. My name is Rizwan, and I am the angel, the guardian of heaven. And I have the keys to heaven. And I have been told to give these keys to the prophet. And I have given them to the prophet. And the prophet has told me that he has given the keys of Jannah to Ali ibn Abi Talib. Now the keys of Jannah is in his hands. He will open the door for anyone that he wants to, and he will close it for anyone that he wants to. And Rizwan will sit, and another angel will come, and he says, if you know me, you know me. If you don't know me, then know me now. My name is Malik. I am the guardian of hell. And the keys of hell are in my hands, and I have given it on the order of Allah to the Prophet. And the Prophet has told me that he has given it in the hands of Ali. So now the door of hell is in the hand of Ali. Anyone that Ali wants to send to hell, he will be sent to hell. Anyone that Ali is going to stop from hell will be stopped from hell. And now it is in his hand. So then Imam Ali at that point says, I ask Rasulullah. So does that mean that if I ask for forgiveness for everyone, they will be forgiven? Rasulullah says, by Allah, I swear to you, Ali, anyone that you want to be forgiven on that day will be forgiven. All of your Shias, when you will look at them and say, you go, they will be forgiven. Imam Ali turns and tells Isbagh, Isbagh, be happy. Take this. Because at that time, I was filled with joy in my heart. And I'm giving this joy to you as I leave. Isbagh says that Imam Ali went into a swoon. And he heard this from Ali. There's one more hadith which I will skip, maybe sometime else, that Imam Ali mentioned at that time. My friends, when we see what Imam Ali went through, you know, the time that he was struck on his head, let me just go through history of that a little bit so you understand what's happening. Imam Ali gave the azan so that the people can come to the masjid. After he gave the azan, you know that he was waking up people and he started to make his nawafil prayer. It was in his nawafil prayer, he was in the mihrab, that Ibn Muljim, may Allah curse him, saw him praying. And he right away jumped at the opportunity, came with the poison sword and struck Imam Ali on the head. As he struck Imam Ali on the head, it is said that when Imam Ali was struck on the head, he did not even say or raise a voice of hurt. He did not even say, ah. He did not even say, ouch. He didn't say anything. He handled it with so much patience that now his head is on the floor, his face is on the floor. You see, the prayer hasn't started yet. People are still coming inside the masjid. They are doing this. The mihrab is dark. No one can see what happened to Imam Ali yet. His face is on the floor and he just stays over there. And the first thing that comes out of his mouth, he says, Bismillahi wa billahi wa ala millati Rasulillah. I ask from Allah, and through His help I ask, and I am on the millat of Rasulullah, on the nation of the Prophet, I am. And the second thing that comes out is Fuztu bi Rabbil Kaaba. Fuztu bi Rabbil Kaaba. It comes out like that. And you know, even then, no one knows Imam Ali is hurt. No one knows that he's in pain. His face is on the ground. There's blood coming out of his face, drenching his beard. It had dyed his beard. And he had a white beard. And now his white beard had turned to red. This was how much blood that comes out of his head. He did not tell anyone yet, but then afterwards, to send the signal to others that there is a wrong and injustice that happened. And Ali, who always fought for justice in his life, just so that justice may be established, he said, "Qatalani la'een." The la'een, a cursed man, has hurt me and killed me. And when he raised that voice, now people realize what's going on, and everyone came around the mihrab and they saw that Imam Ali is on the ground, his face is on the ground. They didn't see the hurt on his head, they didn't see the injury on his head. They looked at him and then they realized there's blood coming out. They realized the blood coming out and they picked him up like that. Imam Ali, in that situation, imagine this, that beautiful moment that he had with Allah. That beautiful moment that he had with Allah. He said, "Ya Allah." And after that he says, "Lemithli amuluka." He says, "Just like me, learn from me that if you can live your whole life," he told the people who came around, "if you can live your whole life just for this moment that I'm going through right now to meet my Rabb, then your life will be worth it. Your life will be worth it if you can live for this moment that I'm living right now. This is worth it, everyone. Live for this moment that you will meet your Creator, that you'll meet your Lord. Live for this moment." And Imam Ali then was taken from there in that situation. This was the 19th of Ramadan, and it was the 21st of Ramadan that now time has come. That the injury, the poison that was in the sword had gone deep into him and it had turned him yellow. When Isbagh entered the room, he said that Ali had a yellow wrap around his head. He had a yellow wrap around his head, like a imama, they put it around his head to wrap the bandage, the injury of the cut in his head. They bandaged him with a yellow wrap. And he said that his face had turned so much yellow that it was yellower than the bandage on his head. And Ali was in so much pain that when he wanted to talk, he would be in so much pain that he's lying down on his back, but his feet would be raised in the air through the pain that he's going through. When they look at the pain that he's going through, he could not handle it. You know, there was a rumor that spread. There's a rumor that spread. The doctor who came there, he, as an advice, he knew the effect of the poison is too much. He knew what's going to happen with this poison. So he told them that, listen, the effect of the poison there, but maybe milk can help him. Milk can help him. So this rumor spread in the town of Kufa, you know. This rumor spread in the town of Kufa. And the next day you see a line of kids, children lined up outside the house of Ali with little bowls of milk in their hands. They asked them, "What are you here for?" He said, "We brought milk for Ali. We heard that this is going to help him." He said, "But who are you?" He said, "We are orphans. We are orphans. Everyone." He said, "I'm an orphan." He said, "How do you know Ali?" He says, "Because Ali used to come to our house and give milk to us. Ali used to come to our house and give the milk to us. So we want to give his milk back so he can become better." My friends, when you see the ghusl and the kafan that was given to Imam Ali, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein were looking after that and they were doing that. But you know what? When Imam Ali gave the ghusl and kafan to Fatima, when he made the grave for Fatima and put Fatima in the grave, then he held Hassan and Hussein. He brought them and said, Hassan, my son Hussein, look very closely. You see how I'm doing this to your mother? You see that I'm doing it in hiding and in secrecy? Hassan and Hussein, remember, you will do the same way to me also. Do my ghusl, do my kafan, and put me in the ground in secrecy. Don't show anyone. Hassan and Hussein, remember what Imam Ali had told them. So they, as they went to bury Imam Ali, they buried him. But what can happen? So many things happened after his death. So many things that they witnessed and everyone witnessed after his death. That which is Ali is now being revealed to the world. As they came back, on their way back from the grave, they made their grave and they came back. They hid the signs of the grave. They were on their way back when they heard a cry, a crying, a wailing of an old man. Imam Hassan goes to the old man and says, "What happened? Why are you here and why are you crying for?" He was a leper. He was someone who was outside the town. He was in a small tent, a broken down tent. He was just crying and wailing. He says, "What happened? Why are you crying?" That person recognized the voice of Hassan, that he recognized the voice that he knows. He says, "Where were you? Where were you? 3 days have passed. You did not come to me. You didn't come to me." Imam Hassan said, I was never here. I never came and saw you. What are you talking about?" He says, You sound the same. You used to come every day. What happened?" He says, "I never came here." Oh, he said, "There was a man who would come here every day and look after me. He would tend to me. He would look after my wounds. He would feed me. And I miss him." He says, Here's some food for you." He says, "I don't want the food. The food was never important for me. It was his company that was important. It was him that was important. I want him." He said, "Who was this person?" And when he mentioned him, Hassan then said, "That person is not coming back to you anymore." He says, "What happened?" "That's my father, Amir al-Mu'mineen. He has passed away. He has gone away." The man said, "Just take me to his grave." Imam Hassan takes him to his grave. And when he reaches the grave, he says, "This is the grave." That person falls on the grave. He says, "I can't live without you."
Ya Mahmud, Bhaki Muhammad. Ya Allah, Bhaki Ali. Ya Fatir al-Samawad, Bhaki Fatima. Ya Muhsin, Bhaki Hassan. Ya Qadim al-Hassan, Bhaki Hussain. Oh Allah, give us the tawfiq to be on the right path, the wisdom to understand his guidance. Hasten the reappearance of our Imam. Make us his helper when he comes. وآخر الدعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين ماتم الحسين.